One Pakistani army commander, who spoke on condition of anonymity as he now serves in a more prominent position in the military, told me that joint operations were rife with deadly miscommunication. He'd lived through one such operation when he was an infantry commander during the initial series of failed counterterrorism efforts in Swat Valley in early 2009. It was still winter, and the air in the mountainous valley was freezing. He was leading his unit of 35 men through the difficult terrain, pursuing a very important terrorist target chosen by the Americans. How important, he never learned. When you're operating in the field, commanding a unit, you do not have the ability to figure out if it is a high-value target, the commander reflected. You're just concerned about taking him out before he takes me out. Overhead, he could see American drones shadowing him. Very few people know that we had a U.S. technical team with us that would have a certain control of Predator drones flying overhead, he said. Of course, with the consent of Pakistan. One such American technical team was some distance away from the combat operations in Swat, monitoring through the drones. The Americans' presence was a matter of strict secrecy. Even the men in the commander's own unit weren't informed of the specifics. But the commander had an open line of radio communication with American officers, and was told Predator strikes could be called in as a force multiplier. According to the commander, on the first night of the operation, his unit closed in on its target, only to watch him escape into a hostile zone they had been ordered against entering. The commander radioed the coordinates to the Americans. The drones had been in close proximity for hours, but no strike came. The following night, another unit, operating about 35 miles away, had a similar encounter with a target and called in a strike. This time, it came, targeting not the terrorists they were pursuing, but the Pakistani unit itself. Our own soldiers, he told me, planting a fist on the table in front of him. We lost 31 of our men, and it was attributed to operator error. We never called for a drone strike ever again. The Pakistanis told the American technical team they wouldn't cooperate. Less than 2 weeks later, the Americans left. The story reflected a sentiment that came up often in conversations with Pakistani military brass. There was an absence of sincerity, the commander said, born of the narrow scope of the relationship and lack of communication. He found it galling how little the Americans seemed to share about the overarching goals of the operations for which he was risking his life. The United States has never shared with us, in formal terms, its end state in Afghanistan, he grumbled. That is the classic example of strategic interaction between the United States and Pakistan. We have been working on the operative issues. We have not been talking about the grand strategic issues that the two nations should be talking to each other about. Another Pakistani military official who was present while we spoke nodded vigorously. Nobody is asking questions of what makes Pakistan do what it does, that second official added. Opinions varied as to whether the compromises of the relationship were worth it. Ann Patterson was of the opinion that we had an extraordinary degree of cooperation with ISI on some of these CT issues, really very unique in the world, a sentiment echoed by many other state, Pentagon, and intelligence officials. On the other hand, just as many had serious misgivings. Petraeus, reflecting on his time as CIA director, told me, ISI was not one of the greatest sources of intel. The bottom line is that there was a very transactional relationship. That debate was pressurized each time deficiencies in Pakistan's counterterrorism cooperation were revealed. When a terrorist narrowly failed to detonate a truck bomb in Times Square in 2010, the FBI learned that the culprit, a 33-year-old Pakistani-American named Faisal Shahzad, had trained in one of Pakistan's terrorist safe havens in Waziristan. They quickly realized that the ISI had done nothing to alert them of the threat. Furious White House officials dressed down the Pakistanis and demanded that they share more intelligence, including passenger data from flights out of Pakistan, and that they stop holding up visas for Americans. In a characteristic show of cognitive dissonance, the Pakistanis insisted they were already sharing everything, then refused to hand over the flight data. The blocking of visas was a particular point of difficulty. When I arrived at State in 2009, the Pakistanis were years into brazenly strangling the flow of travel documents for U.S. officials. The crackdown was a concession to anti-American sentiment within Pakistan, including fears that CIA agents were slipping into the country en masse. The cost to civilian assistance efforts was considerable. Often, State Department officials simply couldn't get into the country. In one case, a day before I was scheduled to depart for a trip to Islamabad, I learned that my months-old visa request was still languishing. As was usually the case with Pakistan, the answer didn't lie with the civilians. Instead, I secured a meeting with the military attaché, Lieutenant General Nazir Ahmed Butt. We met in his large office on the fourth floor of Pakistan's embassy, with a view of China's across the street. But, in full uniform with three stars on his collar, was distinguished-looking, with a graying chevron mustache and, unusually for a Pakistani, electric blue eyes. He leaned back and listened intently as an assistant poured tea out of a china pot dusted with pink flowers, and I spoke about the importance of working with Pakistani civil society, trying my best. An hour later, I walked out of the embassy with a multiple-entry visa, good for a year. Not everyone was so lucky. At any given time, hundreds of applications were pending, requiring direct clearance by the Pakistani military or intelligence operatives. The situation finally became so problematic that Hillary Clinton raised it with Pakistani Prime Minister Yousuf Raza Gilani. Gilani quietly authorized Hussein Haqqani to begin approving visas without going through Islamabad, making him, as Haqqani put it, visa czar. Over the course of the following year, he approved a wave of American visa requests, keeping the relationship from tilting into hostilities. He was, in his view, papering over a lot of problems between Pakistan and the U.S. Haqqani knew his efforts would draw suspicion from the Pakistani political establishment. For him, as was the case with Robin Rafel's misunderstood diplomatic endeavors, talking to the other side was about to become a dangerous game. Chapter 10. Farmer Holbrook. Unable to move the needle away from what he called millthink, Richard Holbrook set to work around its margins. He still felt that any hope for success depended on broadening America's role, in both Afghanistan and Pakistan, beyond tactics. On the Afghan side of the border, he proposed a flood of new civilian-led assistance. Prompted by his agitation, the Obama administration requested from Congress $800 million more for reconstruction in 2009 than the Bush administration had the year before. Holbrook commandeered control of U.S. aid projects, insisting on signing off on many of them personally. He was able to secure that control because USAID reports to the State Department. His outsize influence was a source of bureaucratic rancor, especially when Holbrook, always a whirling dervish of activity, would leave projects awaiting approval for months, unwilling to relinquish control. But he considered the move necessary. Afghanistan was full of expensive, embarrassing USAID boondoggles, from cobblestone roads that Afghans considered unusable as they hurt camels' feet, to farming projects on land with groundwater too salty to sustain crops, to fertilizer handouts that inadvertently enhanced poppy cultivation and, in turn, Afghanistan's drug economy. When Holbrook was in Vietnam, USAID had a robust corps of technical specialists in areas like agriculture. By the Obama administration, decades of budget cuts had shrunk the size of the workforce and robbed it of such expertise. The funding USAID did receive was often mismanaged and misspent, with projects going to American mega-contractors with high overhead and little understanding of circumstances on the ground. This was one of the symptoms of the imbalance that had bedeviled Holbrook throughout his career. By the modern war on terror, almost all of the capacity and resources lay instead on the military side. Holbrook was convinced that the key was agriculture. The U.S. military, which led many of the counter-narcotics efforts in the region, had long contended that lucrative poppy cultivation for heroin sustained the Taliban. So the Bush administration had focused on crop eradication, slashing and burning its way through Afghanistan's fields. Holbrook was incensed by this. He pointed to intelligence assessments that showed support from Pakistan and the Gulf states was far more central to the Taliban's livelihood. He argued that eradication pushed penniless farmers into the arms of the Taliban, often their only source of employment after their crops were wiped out. He set out to refocus the United States on supporting Afghan farmers. They need the kind of soup-to-nuts agricultural support that Roosevelt gave farmers during the Great Depression, he said. He was a man possessed. Pomegranates, once a lucrative export for the Afghans, were a particular obsession. At Hallbrook's request, I organized dozens of meetings focused on the fruit. Sometimes he'd cut me off in the middle of an unrelated sentence and say, from a faraway place, "Where are we on the pomegranates?" By the end of his first year on the job, Richard Hallbrook, a man who, as far as I was aware, had never so much as kept a potted cactus alive, could explain the pomegranates' required levels of moisture, favorable types of soil, and ideal timeline for harvest. Hillary Clinton took to calling him Farmer Hallbrook. But despite Hallbrook's efforts, civilian reconstruction remained dwarfed by an order of magnitude by the Pentagon's programs in the same space. In the early years of George W. Bush's administration, state reconstruction spending sometimes outweighed the Pentagon's by a ratio of more than 10 to 1. By the time Hallbrook came to state, the situation had nearly reversed. The trend lines were hard to miss. From 2008 to 2010, state spending on reconstruction in Afghanistan jumped from $2.2 billion to $4.2 billion, while the Pentagon's budget for similar efforts more than tripled from $3.4 billion to $10.4 billion. This included a sea of development projects conventionally associated with state and U.S. aid, ranging from counter-narcotics programs to education to the catch-all Commander's Emergency Response Program, which was primarily used for road building and repair. The Army Corps of Engineers, likewise, worked on infrastructure projects around the country, and USAID was sometimes the last to know. Even for the projects underwritten through the new USAID and State Department funding, Hallbrook had trouble disentangling development and military objectives. Counterinsurgency strategy was typically described in three steps: clear, hold, build. As in, clear the area of the enemy, hold it with our forces, and begin to build capacity. As the first year of the Obama administration wore on, that coin language, ripped from Petraeus' counterinsurgency manual, began appearing in USAID development contracts. One request for applications for a community-based development initiative called for USAID's partner charities to enable coin-focused, unstable communities to directly implement small-scale, community-level projects, and support military efforts in communities by helping to hold areas after they are cleared. Security and development objectives in an active theater of war are never completely separable, but there had, historically, been an acknowledgement that development should be driven by technical expertise and long-term goals, not shackled to tactics. Explicitly militarizing the contract language was new, and it turned out tone-deaf. The non-governmental organizations applying for the contracts revolted. The head of one charity told me its staffers had been targeted for attacks based on their visible identification with the military. Others said it was destroying trust with communities of Afghans who were comfortable with American reconstruction, but not American military might. Hallbrook correctly judged that the years of narrow, military-driven engagement under the Bush administration had also atrophied relationships with civil society, especially at a local level. Large American companies took equally large commissions, then subcontracted to other groups, which in turn sometimes subcontracted yet again. The result was obvious: massive inefficiency and a lack of accountability. One of the first problems? The United States simply wasn't aware what groups were on the ground and where. Hallbrook's response was typically ambitious. He asked me to track every NGO in Afghanistan and Pakistan. I enlisted the one computer science geek I knew, a programmer named Jillian Kozira, who was snapped up by Google soon after. And we pulled all-nighters in my tiny basement studio on U Street as I designed and she coded. Using the programming language Ruby, she built a scraping application, an automated tool that extracts data from internet sources, married to Google Maps and basic analysis tools that could, for instance, break out a pie chart of different types of civil society activity in a given area. At the end of the process, we had a map of Afghanistan and Pakistan, populated with more than 100,000 local groups. We put it up on an open, non-government URL that I purchased. Hallbrook was delighted by the technology and asked me to present it at the White House, the Pentagon, and our embassies in Afghanistan and Pakistan. But the project also illustrated, in miniature, the pitfalls of his bull-in-a-china-shop approach. The American contractors were incensed by Hallbrook's push away from them. They began lobbying for his firing and complaining about the focus on local NGOs in the press. And as in all of Hallbrook's endeavors, the military was an overpowering and not always friendly counterpart. Within 2 years of the first demonstrations of the NGO tracking technology, both Pentagon and CIA lawyers descended on my office. Where had this mysterious technology come from, they wanted to know. Where was I getting my data? Who was funding it? The answer was, of course, that this was a jury-rigged solution using open-source data and tools at the cost of a single domain name. Both agencies asserted ownership of the work product, but did nothing with it. When I left government after nearly 4 years, the United States still lacked the basic database of civil society entities Hallbrook had sought. Later, I received a large manila envelope from an anonymous P.O. box in Virginia. Inside was an application form for a job interview process to be conducted under a strict veil of secrecy. A timed online test and a series of meetings at hotel bars with unnamed officials followed. They had little interest in my work at State. Would I be willing to depart to work as a lawyer or journalist under non-official cover, they asked. Come on, said one interviewer. What you're all doing over there is a sideshow. This is the real work. Like most things Hallbrook, SRAP was ambitious and exciting and, for many, alienating. Prioritizing outsiders over career Foreign Service officers made the office hated inside the State Department bureaucracy. The interagency convening role he had taken upon himself was the traditional domain of the White House, and this was a particularly controlling White House. These were original sins for which Hallbrook would never fully atone. From the moment we started, the system went to work expelling this peculiar creation, like a body rejecting a transplanted organ. It would cost Hallbrook, and some would later argue, the country, dearly. Chapter 11. A Little Less Conversation. A week after the ceremony in the Ben Franklin Room announcing Richard Hallbrook's role in January 2009, Hallbrook and Hussein Haqqani sat in the Hay Adams Hotel's Lafayette dining room, an airy, light-filled hall with cream-colored walls and wide views of the White House. The property was once home to career diplomat and Secretary of State John Hay, and the legendary salons he and neighbor and political scion Henry Adams hosted for D.C.'s intellectual elites. In the 1920s, their homes had been razed to make way for the elegant Italian Renaissance complex where Haqqani and Hallbrook now lunched. Hallbrook had passing encounters with Haqqani over the course of their overlapping diplomatic careers. The two had struck up a rapport in 2008 when Haqqani became ambassador to the U.S. and Hallbrook, who was at the time chairman of the Asia Society, began making trips to build up his bona fides in the region. The day his new role was formally announced, he had called Haqqani and suggested they have lunch. Someplace where they'd be seen, he'd said wryly but pointedly. The Hay Adams was hard to top for visibility. Yet such a consideration also captured Hallbrook as a creature of another era, when being seen at a prominent locale sent a signal, and when there was a clique of interested power brokers and observers ready to receive such a transmission. The truth is, nobody was paying attention. Hallbrook laid out his goals. He wanted an end to the war in Afghanistan and a stable Pakistan. He wanted a settlement. As always, he asked incisive questions, many of them about bringing regional parties to the table. Could the United States be friends with both India and Pakistan at the same time, he asked. He wanted a more candid discussion of Pakistan's national interests. If there's one thing Haqqani knew from experience, it was that candor would be hard to come by. Remember one thing, Haqqani warned Hallbrook. This is not Yugoslavia. He quoted a passage from Hallbrook's book about Bosnia to end a war. The leaders of all three sides were willing to let their people die while they argued. In the subcontinent, Haqqani went on, it's not just that. People are unwilling and do not know what compromise means. This is not going to be as easy as you think. The two men, both for different reasons, outsiders in their political establishments, and both staring down the hardest foreign policy problem in the world, looked at each other. Hallbrook observed that the new American president's pivot to the region might make life hard for Haqqani, too. Increased focus and scrutiny raise questions to which there are no easy answers. He said he didn't envy Haqqani's job. The feeling was mutual. Over the course of the ensuing 2 years, the two men became close. Holbrooke would jolt Haqqani out of bed at 7 a.m. with calls about his latest diplomatic schemes. They'd take walks together near Holbrooke's Georgetown townhouse. On weekends, when Holbrooke's wife was out of town, they'd go to the movies. In March 2010, they walked to the E Street Cinema to see The Ghostwriter, Roman Polanski's thriller about a British prime minister accused of war crimes while working too closely with the Americans, and his wife, who turns out to be a CIA agent. Afterwards, Holbrooke and Haqqani got frozen yogurt. Pieces of Holbrooke's desired region-wide role had been carted off before he could grab them. The Iran job had been commandeered by the White House, who appointed Dennis Ross to head up dialogue with that state. In an even bigger blow, the Indians, whose meteoric economic rise made them a far greater diplomatic center of gravity than the Pakistanis, pitched a fit at the idea of being included in Holbrooke's war portfolio alongside a rogue state like Pakistan. They successfully lobbied the Obama transition team to nix any India envoy role, and particularly one involving Holbrooke. Holbrooke told me he intended to address the Indian elephant in the room anyway, and proceeded to regularly include said elephant in his regional diplomacy. And the Indians weren't his only targets. In February 2010, he had his staffers, including myself, assemble a list of his international travel in the job. It was exhausting to behold. In the first 2 months of 2010 alone, his shuttle diplomacy included trips to 20 cities in nearly as many countries. London, Abu Dhabi, Islamabad, Kabul, New Delhi, Paris, Munich, Doha, Riyadh, Tashkent, Tbilisi, Berlin, the list went on and on. Alongside the list of cities, we noted commitments he had secured from foreign partners for either Afghanistan or Pakistan. New Delhi pledged continued civilian assistance to and increased trade with Afghanistan, along with a promise to avoid provocative assistance in the security sector. The Russians at one point offered technical military training and helicopter maintenance for the Pakistanis. This was a global threat, and Holbrooke intended to build a global solution. The dream was to bring the Pakistanis and Indians together to defuse the root causes of Pakistan's support for terrorists. He even set up a secret meeting between himself, Haqqani, and former Indian High Commissioner to Pakistan, S.K. Lamba. "We met together once," Haqqani admitted. Holbrooke encouraged me and the Indians to talk. But Haqqani considered his own country inhospitable to any meaningful negotiations. "What will satisfy the Pakistanis," he mused, "short of India stopping to exist?" The India-Pakistan problem required a fundamental shift in the posture of the negotiating parties, the kind that Holbrooke achieved in Dayton only with the robust backing of the White House and the threat of military strikes he could meaningfully direct. In this case, he barely had a mandate to talk to the Indians, and frequently had to do so in secret to avoid irritating not only the Pakistanis, but also the White House. Here, the military was driving engagement. Here, he would have to work around the limitations of his job description. Another great challenge was simply talking to the Pakistanis. Years of conversation conducted between intelligence agencies, with blinders on to any broader dialogue, had worked during the war with the Soviets. But during that conflict, the Pakistanis and the Americans had been on the same side. Both needed the invading forces out of the region, each for their own reasons. The relationship was already fraught with deception in other areas, like Pakistan's nuclear development. But there was at least a strategic alignment. There wasn't broader dialogue, but there didn't need to be. In the global war on terrorism, the Americans attempted to rebuild the same relationship, but there was an essential difference that was almost impossible to overcome. This time, Pakistan was on the other side. Now we wanted Al-Qaeda-aligned militants out of the region, but Pakistan had kept right on using them as a proxy force, just like we taught them to. However often the Pakistanis appeared to accede to American demands for cooperation, they always had goals opposed to those of the United States. If Pakistan was going to reconsider its basic priorities, there needed to be a broader and more honest conversation. To succeed, Holbrooke would have to turn the uneasy transactions of proxy war into a true diplomatic alliance, or something closer to it. Holbrooke knew that coaxing the Pakistanis into broader dialogue would require a show of commitment from the United States in areas other than military assistance. He needed action, or at least money. In April 2009, he gathered many of the countries on his international engagement list for a donors conference in Tokyo, where he wooed them into $5 billion of pledges to Pakistan. "That is a respectable IPO," he joked. "Was it enough?" a reporter asked. "Pakistan needs $50 billion," Hallbrook said, "not $5 billion. Back home, he and David Petraeus followed up with a frenzy of lobbying. "Richard and I worked that very hard on the Hill," Petraeus told me. "I remember the two of us worked that together." It was the zenith of Hallbrook's BlackBerry jiu-jitsu, as he worked every connection he had in every legislator's office. In September 2009, the Senate unanimously authorized $7.5 billion in new assistance to Pakistan over 5 years. The legislation was named Kari Luger Berman for its sponsors. It was the first long-term civilian aid package to Pakistan, born of a deliberate effort to roll back the almost exclusively military-to-military nature of the relationship. That was a grand strategic attempt to address the perception that the U.S. was only engaging with the Pakistani military and didn't care about democracy or the Pakistani people, recalled Alan Cronstadt, the Congressional Research Service's analyst on Pakistan assistance. But changing those perceptions proved more difficult than any of the Americans had bargained for. The day the Kari Luger Berman Act passed, Mark Siegel, Benazir Bhutto's lobbyist, held a party at his house. He had brought his Pakistan account to his firm at the time, Locke Lord, and a large crowd of employees, Pakistani diplomats, and politicians toasted the achievement. Less than 24 hours later, the fallout began. Mohsin Kamal, a young Pakistani lobbyist, had joined Siegel's firm the day of the party. He expected to capitalize on an apparent thaw in the relationship. Instead, his first job was frantic damage control. Items began appearing in Pakistani outlets excoriating the bill. It was degrading, with "vicious designs on Pakistan's sovereignty," raged The Nation. "An affront to the country in the eyes of its people," opined diplomat Malia Lodi in The News. Even the Pakistani army chief, General Kayani, expressed outrage and privately harangued U.S. officials. At issue was a requirement that the U.S. Secretary of State annually certify that Pakistan was meeting basic thresholds for good behavior to keep security assistance flowing. That included cooperation on ensuring nuclear weapons stayed out of terrorists' hands, ceasing support for extremist and terrorist groups, and helping to confront the safe havens in Fatah and Quetta. It was, in fact, a pretty modest nod to accountability. The certification requirements only applied to security-related assistance, and even then could be waived freely for any national security reason. In practice, this was a no-strings-attached gift. Few legislators in America had considered the possibility that it would actually threaten to burn down the entire relationship. But in Pakistan, paranoia is a national pastime. This episode, like just about everything else, prompted two reactions. Some were convinced it was evidence of Indian meddling, and some were convinced it was Hussein Haqqani's fault. "Hussein Haqqani did something very stupid," was Mohsin Kamal's straightforward reading of events. "He put those provisions in." As the furor grew, Hallbrook gathered staffers in his office for a crisis session. He paced back and forth in his socks. Hallbrook's chosen response, ceded to any reporter who would listen, was to insist that the assistance came with no conditions, which he jokingly referred to as the C-word. John Kerry, whose name the legislation bore, was dispatched to Islamabad to try to pacify the Pakistanis. "We did a whole apology tour with Kari Luger Berman, where we met with Nawaz and the whole gang over there," remembered one senior official. On one occasion, Kerry sat for 5 hours with General Kayani over dinner. "We want to give you this money. We want to change the nature of our relationship," Kerry told him. "But to be able to do that, you guys have to be sensitive to how you're going to be perceived if you continue to do some of the bad things that you've been doing." "Look, I'm a politician too," replied Kayani. "I understand your politics. I know how difficult this is." As was so often the case, the Pakistanis had one message for their people and another for the Americans. I wondered for a moment what an outside observer might make of this madness. A supposed ally convulsed with rage over a $7.5 billion handout, and a world power bending over backward to deny that said handout contained any accountability. The situation held a mirror to the deep problems in the relationship. Hallbrook had tried to buy a broader conversation, but Pakistan had been a proxy for America's military interests for too many years. While the conversations between spy chiefs and generals flourished, the untended broader relationship had become a petri dish for paranoia and suspicion. $7.5 billion couldn't buy it back. Robin Rafel said yes to the job offer from Ann Patterson, the U.S. ambassador to Pakistan at the time. The month before the Kerry Lugar Berman Act passed the House and Senate in September 2009, she packed up her things and moved to Islamabad one more time. She settled into life in a two-story stucco house in Islamabad's comfortable, leafy F6 sector, right next to the Margalla Hills. She got a refurbished Toyota and drove herself to parties and functions. During my trips to Islamabad, I saw her working her way through house parties thrown by Russian diplomats and British charity heads, always thronged by Pakistanis. Robin Rafel was back among the Islamabad elites she'd known since her 20s. The task of spending the new flood of money that Hallbrook and Petraeus had fought for on the Hill fell to her. I believed at the time, and still do, it was a good idea to do Kerry Lugar Berman, to make a grand gesture, to help raise the standard of living overall for the people and not just the military, she told me. But spending the money proved just as fraught as announcing it. This, too, was partly an echo of the long history of transactional rapport. The relationship simply wasn't set up to accommodate $1.5 billion a year in civilian assistance. It quickly became apparent that there was more money authorized than USAID could spend effectively. The result was, in the eyes of many Pakistanis, yet another broken promise, a hyped-up number that, after all the furor, never became a reality. As in Afghanistan, there was a lack of technical expertise. In certain areas, like water infrastructure, there just wasn't anyone qualified at USAID. I began pulling in outside groups and linking them up with the Pakistani government and USAID. But no amount of outside expertise could get the machine of U.S. assistance moving fast enough to fit the timeline set by the wartime legislation. The fact is, we weren't doing much, admitted Rafel, because it takes a very long time to get going on stuff. So there was this huge expectation build-up, and there was no way we could meet it. The same broken system that blighted Hallbrook's efforts in Afghanistan frustrated Rafel's struggle to get projects through the pipeline faster. Despite the quest to identify local NGOs, much of the Kerry Lugar Berman money went through hulking American contractors using layers of subcontracts. We pissed away most of that money to contractors, Rafel said flatly. And there wasn't enough time to fix the issues. 5 years are the blink of an eye in the context of infrastructure projects, and shorter than that in terms of the long-term relationship change Hallbrook sought to effect. I didn't realize right at the beginning that it should have been a 10-year program, not a 5-year program, Rafel told me later, because we couldn't figure out quickly enough how to spend the money well. Yet again, timelines dictated by military exigencies and domestic political pressures didn't fit with the realities of diplomacy and development. Then there was the pushback from the groups responsible for implementing the assistance, who, just like in Afghanistan, had little desire to be identified as a part of the American war effort. Hallbrook and Petraeus sold Kerry Lugar Berman on simple logic. We'd spend a lot of money on dams and schools, Pakistanis would see all those American dollars flowing, and, hey, presto, Pakistan would transform from an avatar of the CIA in shadowy counterterrorism operations to a friend of the United States. Meetings about assistance to Pakistan often devolved into senior officials making increasingly desperate pleas for highly visible signature projects that could bring about this fabled winning of hearts and minds. Hallbrook wanted that as much as anyone. In a picture taken at a refugee camp in northwest Pakistan, he slouches next to a bearded Pakistani refugee who sits lotus-style with his young daughter in his lap. Hallbrook has taken off his sunglasses, and sincere sympathy is written on his face, along with intense focus. Tufts of his graying hair stick out from underneath a khaki-colored hat emblazoned with USAID, and then underneath its slogan, From the American People. He took to wearing it a lot. Seems like Pakistani press is taking particular interest in RCH, Hallbrook's initials, baseball cap, Vali Nasr wrote in an email to Holbrook and his chief of staff, Rosemary Pauly. Does that have deeper meaning, Dr. Freud? Holbrook wrote back. It was practically the only sign, however temporary, that there was a U.S. civilian effort. Every other country's aid here, even Iran's, is better branded than us. Only our helicopters are visible. China's field hospital, which I drove by in Thatta, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, I visited their refugee camp where they are building a mosque, Australia, field hospital in Multan, Switzerland, UK, etc. While we hide and the NGO partners refuse to admit that we fund them. Holbrook was right. In sensitive areas of Pakistan, rife with violent anti-American sentiment, non-governmental groups often tried to minimize the Stars and Stripes, fearing they could trigger attacks on workers. In the most volatile areas, the U.S. even permitted the complete scrubbing of flags and USAID logos through waivers. This had long been a gentleman's agreement, but Holbrook began agitating, publicly and privately. He forwarded the exchange to Clinton aide Jake Sullivan, who forwarded it to Clinton. Days later, she raised the issue publicly, saying, "We have to fight to get the U.S. government's label on our material because a lot of our aid workers and our NGO partners are afraid to have association with the U.S. government." Suddenly, we were at war with the groups responsible for much of the assistance at the heart of the Afghanistan-Pakistan strategy. "We're aiding Pakistan. Don't put a target on our backs," blared the headline of a Washington Post op-ed written by the head of the NGO coalition Interaction. In countries such as Liberia or Congo, U.S. NGOs that get funding from the U.S. government routinely promote the fact that they are delivering help from the American people, wrote Sam Worthington. But in Pakistan, where aid workers' lives are more often at stake, an enforced branding campaign could put the lives of Americans and their Pakistani colleagues at risk. I was dispatched to quiet the storm, bringing the groups into the State Department and heading to a summit of NGOs to make the case against a boycott. Both sides dug in. Judith McHale, the former Discovery Channel executive serving as Clinton's Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy, emailed the op-ed to Clinton, saying, "As you know, I believe passionately that it is not in our national interests to continue to provide billions of dollars in aid and assistance without the very people we are helping knowing we are the ones providing the assistance." Clinton replied, "Thanks. I love working with you. I feel sometimes we were separated at birth." Jake Sullivan chimed in an email to McHale, "Surely they shouldn't hide their support, offering it covertly." He added, using the one-letter abbreviation for the Secretary of State, "S believes we should expand this beyond Pakistan, make the case for displaying the support of the American people throughout the world." As the crisis management email chains ballooned, I was pulled in to help draft an op-ed that would run under the byline of Rajiv Shah, the head of USAID. I was, absurdly given my junior rank, the only person actively communicating with the groups threatening to pull out. It struck me that there was a thoughtful solution here. A more specific conversation, not about whether American branding should be used, but about when and where and how. Essentially, an adjustment of the waiver policy that was already in place. Other changes, like working with local groups that had expressed a willingness to use the American flag even in difficult areas, could have a greater impact than focusing on strong-arming Western groups that already faced controversy in Pakistan. In a series of memos to Holbrook and emails to the group, I tried to gently make the case. Holbrook hit the roof. He called me into his office one night after a reply I'd sent to the group suggesting a public acknowledgement of the waivers already available for unsafe areas. His face was slick with perspiration, and he looked exhausted. He was, by then, facing off against an unfriendly White House almost daily. "Have you taken leave of your senses?" he thundered. He snatched the memo I'd brought him with such force it tore in half. I looked at the jagged half page in my hand, and then at a vein standing out on Holbrook's forehead. "I know you think you're special," he raged on. "I know you think you have a destiny, that you'll do great things, that you'll make a difference for your country. I know you've felt sure of it ever since you were young." Even at the time, it was hard to avoid the feeling he'd stopped himself from saying, "since you were in Vietnam." A picture of young Holbrook, smiling from behind Coke bottle glasses in the sunlight of the Mekong Delta, stared at us from a nearby wall. "But you have got to know your place," to pick your battles, to realize that even the best point isn't a good point if no one wants to hear it. And right now, no one wants to hear, Donna! His assistant, a mild-mannered southern grandmother named Donna Deshban, was standing outside his office door, gaping at us, weeping openly. Donna, stop crying, he bellowed. The op-ed from Rajiv Shah ran in the Huffington Post with a brief mention of waivers. None of the major implementers pulled out, and the assistance continued. But the dream of a sweeping new civilian assistance agenda in Pakistan never quite materialized. Much of the funding was never even appropriated by Congress. In some cases, acts of God interfered. U.S. responses to flooding and a refugee crisis had to be bankrolled with the authorized funds. Humanitarian aid siphoned off a lot of that, said Kronstad, the congressional researcher. More significantly, changes were afoot that would dramatically alter the stakes of the relationship, and with those changes came dramatically smaller appropriations. In March 2010, Clinton and Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi sat at the head of a series of long tables arranged in a rectangle in the Ben Franklin Room. Behind them stood alternating U.S. and Pakistani flags, red, white, and blue, juxtaposing white crescents on green. A Pakistani delegation sat on Qureshi's side and the Americans on Clinton's, with Holbrooke around the corner from her. Even with the odds arrayed against him in his civilian funding surges in Afghanistan and Pakistan, Holbrooke forged ahead trying to bring the players to the table. He convinced Clinton that Pakistan, like weightier allies India and China, should receive an annual strategic dialogue, a high-level ceremonial talk on the most pressing issues in the relationship. Little of substance was discussed at that first meeting, and the commitments Qureshi did secure were all in the traditional arena of counterterrorism cooperation. We've agreed to fast-track our requests that have been pending for months and years on the transfer of military equipment to Pakistan, he gushed to reporters. But the mere fact that it had occurred, after so many mishaps, was a small miracle. After the talks, Clinton stood with Qureshi in front of the blue walls and Corinthian pillars of the State Department Treaty Room and thanked Pakistan for its friendship. Holbrooke framed the talks as the beginning of a new kind of relationship. Pakistan is important in its own right. We don't view it simply as a function of its giant neighbor to the east or its war-torn neighbor to the west. It was more aspiration than reality, but it was a start. Holbrooke made the most of the opening. He championed additional trilateral talks with Afghanistan. Working groups were spun out to address specific issues. Those were sometimes his best chance to tackle big challenges that exceeded his mandate, like restrictions on trade that were driven by animosity between Pakistan and India and strangled Pakistan's economy. He couldn't bring India to the table, but he pushed aggressively on trilateral talks with the United States, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, culminating in the signing of an agreement to open up trade. It was the first breakthrough in a negotiating process that had been stalled, literally, since 1965. In 2015, even India began to signal its willingness to enter the trade pact. Another trilateral working group's focus, water policy, became a fixation for Holbrooke. In a little publicized view, he came to believe mounting tensions over water issues could trigger a complete collapse of the uneasy peace between India and Pakistan. The Indus River Basin fed both countries, running through India and disputed Kashmir on its way to Pakistan. A 1960 treaty, negotiated by the World Bank, split the various Indus rivers between the two countries. But climate change was putting stress on the tenuous arrangement. Floods threatened farmland on both sides of the border, increasing the risk of turf wars. Drought could trigger a similar effect, and was already a visible trend. One study predicted that shrinking glaciers would reduce the flows of the Indus by 8% by 2050. If we ignore this, Holbrooke told me, it could very well precipitate World War III. I gave him an incredulous look. He stayed absolutely serious. Holbrooke raised the water dimension of the regional struggle in a National Security Council session, hoping he could expand his effort with higher-level support. White House officials were incredulous and asked whether he was kidding. If there were any laughs to be had, Holbrooke's would be the last. In 2016, the Indians began making ominous threats to pull out of the Indus Waters Treaty. Realizing he was being frozen out, Holbrooke fought to have another official, Undersecretary of State Maria Otero, serve in a sort of informal water envoy role. As usual, he was never confident that anyone who wasn't him could do a job. "Is she okay?" he asked me after one of his briefing sessions with her. "Is she smart enough for this? This is important." And he kept pushing on talks. I spent months traipsing around the world with the Water Working Group to make sure they were integrating outside experts that could help them prepare for a potential crisis. A refrigerator magnet, inexplicably given to me by the Pakistani government, shows me, a handful of Department of Agriculture officials, and a Pakistani minister giving a thumbs up next to equipment used for testing groundwater levels. At one point, we sat at the garish Ritz-Carlton in Doha trying to jumpstart a come-to-Jesus conversation between India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan on the subject. Bearded Afghans sat next to artificial lagoons declining piña coladas. It felt like a waste of time. India refused to send an official envoy. But Holbrooke didn't think he was tilting at windmills. Conversations between regional players, however halting, were happening to an extent that hadn't been seen in years, and the Pakistanis were moving against terrorists within their own borders to an extent they'd never managed before. There was a period in 2009 where we thought, "This thing is really working," Petraeus told me. And that was the period in which they did SWAT, Peshawar, Momand, Khyber, Oryxzai, South Waziristan. We were providing fair amounts of financial, intel, training, infrastructure, and logistics assistance, and we felt it was going very well. Holbrooke seemed buoyed. Despite the obstacles, he told me, he was edging towards something important. Chapter 12. A-Rod. Just after Thanksgiving in 2010, a sleek Falcon 900EX triple-engine jet touched down at the snow-blanketed Munich airport. The jet belonged to the Bundesnachrichtendienst, Germany's CIA, and had taken off from Qatar. On board was a man named Syed Tayyab Aga. He was in his late 30s, with youthful features and a neat black beard. He spoke English, choosing his words carefully, with a calm, measured demeanor. Aga was a longtime aide to Taliban leader Mullah Omar and had served in the regime's embassy in Pakistan. He had been involved in years of sputtering efforts to start talks with the outside world, including an approach to the Afghans in 2008. His flight to Germany was the culmination of a year of careful negotiation led by Holbrooke's German counterpart, Michael Steiner. Steiner, a thin, distinguished-looking man with craggy features and stooped shoulders, had also been Holbrooke's German counterpart during Bosnia. He had a similar reputation for aggressive negotiating tactics and larger-than-life theatrics. During a later stint as ambassador to India, he and his wife staged a reenactment of a popular Bollywood movie, complete with Steiner lip-syncing his way through song and dance numbers, that surely ranks as one of the strangest YouTube videos ever uploaded by the German Foreign Office. He also shared Holbrooke's belief that talks were the only way out of Afghanistan. German agents had communicated with Aga only indirectly, through intermediaries who kept his location secret. He confirmed his identity to the Germans by posting specific, agreed-upon messages on official Taliban websites. Aga was whisked away to a German intelligence safe house in an upscale village in the Bavarian countryside, not far from the city. Security was tight, with the area surrounding the safe house locked down. The next day, two Americans trudged through the cold to the house. One was a White House staffer named Jeff Hayes. The other was our deputy on Holbrooke's team, Frank Ruggiero, who had served as the civilian advisor to the military in the Taliban stronghold of Kandahar. They joined Steiner, a Qatari prince who attended at Aga's insistence as a guarantor of safety, and Aga. It was the first time in a decade the United States had talked to the Taliban. For Aga, the stakes were high. He was on German and American terrorist watch lists, and came only on commitments from both countries that he wouldn't be arrested. Should Al-Qaeda, or the Al-Qaeda-friendly factions within Pakistan's ISI, discover the talks, he risked a more gruesome fate. There was risk for the Americans, too. Just a year before, a supposed double agent informing on Al-Qaeda to the Jordanian intelligence agency had been welcomed into a base in Khost, Afghanistan. He turned out to be a triple agent, detonating a bomb and killing 7 CIA officers. The memory was still fresh for everyone working on Afghanistan. German intelligence promised the Americans Aga had been vetted and searched. The group was together for 11 hours. Several were devoted to sightseeing. The Taliban official was excited to see traditional German castles. 6 hours were spent talking. Aga outlined the Taliban's main concerns. Its leaders wanted to be clearly distinguished from Al-Qaeda, asked that Taliban names be removed from a UN sanctions list, and sought permissions to open a political office in Qatar, not just in Pakistan where they currently operated. There was one more, almost obsessive focus. They wanted the release of Taliban prisoners held by the U.S. in Afghanistan and at Guantanamo Bay. The Americans outlined their conditions, that the Taliban lay down arms, renounce Al-Qaeda, and accept the Afghan constitution and its protections for women. And the United States had its own prisoner request. It wanted the release of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, who had been captured by the Taliban after deserting from the army a year before. After Aga left, the negotiators were elated. Holbrooke, who had been obsessively monitoring the talks from afar, met Ruggiero's flight back the next day at Dulles. At Harry's Tap Room on Concourse B, Holbrooke ordered a cheeseburger, and Ruggiero briefed him on every detail. This was not an intensive negotiation, not yet, but Aga hadn't balked at the American conditions. It was the most important break to date in Western efforts to drive a wedge between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. "Remember this moment," Holbrooke had told Ruggiero when he tapped him to make the trip a month earlier. "We may be on the verge of making history." It was a Sunday afternoon in October 2010, and Ruggiero was driving over the Benjamin Franklin Bridge in Philadelphia with his 7-year-old daughter when he got the call. As instructed, he never forgot. For a variety of reasons, to avoid public scrutiny, to avoid the fallout should the contact prove to be a fake, to skirt the perils of his fraught relationship with the White House, Holbrooke had decided against attending the first meeting himself. But the expectation was that he would take charge of any further negotiations. Holbrooke had first heard about Aga during one of his whirlwind international rallying efforts in Cairo in the fall of 2009. The Egyptians told him that Taliban leaders, including an aide to Mullah Omar, had visited them. Steiner and the German diplomats, who had also made contact, felt Aga was authentic. And, tantalizingly, he was willing to talk to the Americans. Clinton, who had initially been skeptical of high-level talks, told Holbrooke to begin exploring the prospect under a strict veil of secrecy. Holbrooke's love of the Yankees had solidified at age 15 when his father refused to let him cut class to see Game 5 of the World Series and what turned out to be Don Larsen's historic perfect game. He took to referring to Aga as A-Rod to keep a lid on leaks. A negotiated settlement with the Taliban had, to that point, been the white whale to Holbrooke's Ahab. Barney Rubin, whose desk sat not far from mine in our State Department suite, had been hired expressly because he was the foremost expert on the Taliban in the Western world. Just before Holbrooke scooped him up in early 2009, Rubin had met with Taliban intermediaries in Kabul and Saudi Arabia. During these exploratory trips, he had probed what conditions had to be met for talks to proceed, and hit upon the same priorities A-Rod later raised. Rubin believed talks were a real possibility. The day Holbrooke was sworn into his job, he met with Rubin about his trip and the prospects for negotiation. "If this thing works," Holbrooke said, "it may be the only way we will get out." Holbrooke didn't consider the decision to deploy more troops to be at odds with the possibility of a political settlement. Quite the opposite. He often talked about using the period of greatest military pressure as leverage to bring parties to the table. It was a tactic he had used to great effect in the Balkans. There were two schools of thought on talking to the Taliban. The modest approach was to peel off and reintegrate low-level fighters, the kind in it for a living wage rather than an ideological fight to the death, from the bottom up. The more ambitious approach, the one Holbrooke and Rubin were discussing, was to bring Taliban leadership to the table to attempt reconciliation. The exhaustive policy review led by Bruce Rydell had endorsed reintegrating low-level fighters, but flatly rejected a peace process. "Taliban leaders are not reconcilable, and we cannot make a deal that includes them," that report concluded. The very idea of such talks ran counter to a basic ethos that had calcified during the Bush years. You don't talk to terrorists. For much of the first 2 years of the Obama administration, we were forbidden from so much as referencing the idea in unclassified communications. Reconciliation, Fali Nasser later said, was a taboo word. The military would say, well, you're talking to the Taliban, you're already throwing in the towel. Holbrooke longed to make his case to the president and lobbied for a meeting, but he never got one. Instead, he argued for a diplomatic approach with anyone else in the administration he could get to. The toughest nut to crack was the military. Much of the leadership, including Petraeus in his seat at CENTCOM, felt talking to the Taliban would interfere with their case for military escalation. But Petraeus's commander in Kabul, McChrystal, began to come around to the idea. He and Holbrooke didn't have an easy relationship, but I saw him listen closely when Holbrooke worked up a lather, unlike Petraeus, who could be more visibly dismissive. An army colonel under McChrystal named Christopher Kalenda, who had been working on reintegration efforts for insurgents at a local level, came to believe the Taliban was growing more moderate in some ways, and to share Holbrooke's view that negotiation held promise. McChrystal was intrigued and contacted Holbrooke, and the two began discussing the pros and cons of reconciliation and how it might fit with the United States military campaign. In early June, McChrystal notified his staff that he was on board with Taliban negotiations, and even began preparing a briefing for Karzai on the subject. A few weeks later, Holbrooke woke up to the sound of his BlackBerry ringing. It was 2:30 a.m., and we were all staying at the U.S. Embassy in Kabul. He in one of the proper visitor suites, I in my hooch, a white Connex shipping container outfitted with a bunk bed, a mini-fridge, and a tiny sink. "Remember to wash your hands," smiley face, read a peeling laminated sign to the left of the sink. "Rocket attack instructions," read a notice to the right. One of said instructions was to hide under the bed, which didn't inspire much confidence. The day before, Holbrooke had been in Marja, a tactically important town that had been reclaimed from the Taliban a few months prior. As he made his approach, Taliban fighters opened fire on his V-22 Osprey, a futuristic but troubled combat aircraft with swiveling tilt rotors that allow it to act as either a helicopter or a plane. He'd descended safely and laughed off the incident to assembled reporters. "I've been shot at in other countries," he said with his usual bravado. "A lot of other countries, actually." But the gunfire continued during his brief visit, and moments after he took off again, three suicide bombers detonated themselves nearby. It was a violent reminder of how ephemeral military victories in Afghanistan were proving to be. I'd stayed behind at the embassy, eating greasy food at the commissary and taking meetings. Holbrooke returned looking spent. By 2:30 a.m., he was fast asleep. The wake-up call was from Stan McChrystal across town at ISAF headquarters. Holbrooke was annoyed. What was possibly urgent enough for this? "There's a Rolling Stone story coming out," McChrystal said, "and I said some embarrassing things in it." "Stan, don't worry about it," said Holbrooke. McChrystal, of course, was right to worry. Michael Hastings' story, the runaway general, had captured McChrystal and his staffers taking a blowtorch to just about everyone in the administration. "The boss says he's like a wounded animal," one member of his team had said of Holbrooke. "Holbrooke keeps hearing rumors that he's going to get fired, so that makes him dangerous. He's a brilliant guy, but he just comes in, pulls on a lever, whatever he can grasp onto. But this is coin, and you can't just have someone yanking on shit." Another memorable moment saw McChrystal looking at his BlackBerry and groaning, "Oh, not another email from Holbrooke. I don't even want to open it." 2 days later, President Obama accepted McChrystal's resignation. Military support for reconciliation departed with him. In McChrystal's stead, Obama installed Petraeus in Afghanistan. This was technically a demotion for Petraeus, since McChrystal had reported to him. But it elevated Petraeus to a far more direct role in shaping policy for the war. And he did not share McChrystal's openness to negotiation. "I just don't think it was negotiable," Petraeus told me. "We certainly tried, and our forces supported the movement and security of potential interlocutors, but I doubted that we could get the right Taliban to come to the table and truly deal. Their non-negotiable red lines were totally unacceptable to the Afghans and to us. And if you couldn't get the true Taliban leaders, you certainly couldn't get the Haqqani Taliban leaders or those of the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan or Al-Qaeda," he said, referring to the more extreme elements across Afghanistan's borders. The leaders of all the groups were sitting in sanctuaries, and it was clear that the Pakistanis at that time were not willing or capable of going after them. he found the incessant calls for negotiations from Holbrook and the State Department to be an unhelpful distraction. There was a belief that if we just tried a little harder, we could get a negotiated settlement, he said. The message given to the military was that, "We're just not trying hard enough. Just put our shoulder to the wheel. You guys are obstacles. You don't want it enough." Years later, Petraeus was still defensive on this point. He argued that he did all humanly possible.